Hey, here we are again for another episode of Old School Guns, the podcast that basically tells you the information that you want to know and helps you understand what's going on around us in Second Amendment issues, media, culture, and also some questions and answers that you have that we have the answers to. So, hope you enjoy listening. First thing, let's talk about celebrity culture and guns yet again. Another fool has appeared on the scene. This time it's Steve Kerr, who's a coach for the Golden State Warriors, a professional basketball team. Mr. Kerr has decided and stated that he hopes the younger generation will vote out lawmakers who do not represent their thoughts on gun control, which are, of course, his thoughts. Many of the younger generation disagree with him. When he says things like AR-15 should not be in the hands of civilians, neither should high-capacity magazines, and, you know, more of this pablum about background checks and those sorts of things. The problem with this is that here's somebody who's completely talking out of his area of expertise. I'm no expert in professional basketball coaching. He is certainly not an expert in anything like gun rights arguments or gun control. And he makes really gratuitous and silly statements. This is all rooted in the fact that his father was a professor at the American University in Lebanon, where he was murdered and was murdered in 1984. And murdered by jihadists, essentially. And now he kind of has carried that tragedy over and reflected it onto American gun owners, which is the wrong thing. He should be worried about the jihadists that actually did the deed. And in fact, that sort of jihadism is still out there. So why is he worried about that? Well, he's not worried about, obviously, the people overseas. He wants to reflect it to people here. And essentially have law-abiding gun owners pay the price for a crime committed overseas by terrorists, murderers, and jihadists. The man's a fool. What he says is garbage. And it just goes to show you that what popular culture and the popular culture extending into sports, what that brings to us as far as intellect goes, it's nothing. One of the things he should probably talk about is the thuggery in basketball and the culture of thuggery and abuse in professional sports. Need we talk about spousal abuse and some of the other drug abuse and some of the other misdeeds that professional athletes do? Why doesn't he comment on that? And the answer is because he gets paid, and that's where his money is. And he's not going to criticize the culture that's basically filling his pockets. In the larger political context, this man has been he's a critic of Donald Trump and Republican policies. So this is nothing more than just party hack type of stuff. I mean, this is the sort of same sort of garbage that Kamala Harris and some of these other fools propagate. And so it again shows you that people who speak outside of their area of expertise, really, when you listen to them, they actually make fools out of themselves. When they try to leverage their own fame, their own position, in order to influence issues to which they haven't studied or know anything about. We see this same kind of nonsense with Hollywood all the time. Because someone is an actor does not make them an expert on anything else. And normally when their academic credentials and background are examined, you find that they know less than the average person. They have less of a grasp of the facts and less experience than the people who they preach to. So it's not surprising, but it is very disappointing. Now let's see, we have some gun culture stuff here. Let's take a quick look at that. On a much more positive note, the NRA has been putting out some good information on some of this information that came out during the annual meetings that they had in Indianapolis. And it appears that, you know, the organization is settling down and getting back to business. I think there'll still be some critics out there, but it's starting to look a whole lot better. One of the things that's that's really disturbing is the social media, the reaction to when NRA members and NRA spokespeople are putting out information, attempting to communicate, and people who've had grudges for an extremely long period of time, in many cases, are just using this as an opportunity to get their cheap shots in. They clearly have a long-term grudges against the NRA, and what they're actually doing is just using this as a fulcrum to try to get their agendas out there, to try to be heard. But most of this is the same kind of carping that's been going on for years. Hey, if you don't like Wayne LaPierre, that's too bad. That's just too bad. He's the guy running it. Go to the meetings and participate. And understand that you're not always going to have your way, even if you do that. You're going to have your voice heard, but it's going to be the majority opinion that's going to carry and the majority vote that's going to restore someone to office or remove someone from an office in the organization. So, you know, it's one of those things. No organization is going to be 100% in sync with 100% of its members. There's always going to be some dissent, and a lot of times you just have to take the good and look at the great things. If you agree with them 80% of the time, 89% of the time, 95% of the time, that's really the organization for you. They are representing you. The fact is that they're not doing it exactly your way 100%. Really doesn't mean much, and it really does mean that they're doing a good job, and sometimes you have to look past it and realize that as adults we don't get our way 100% of the time. On some more positive notes, and this is not strictly Second Amendment, but I think most people who would listen to this podcast would be interested in the Battleship Texas, the former USS Texas, a battleship that has been in the Houston Shipping Channel at the San Jacinto battleground since 1946, the last surviving dreadnought, the last battleship that fought in World War I and World War II. Well, the Texas in the last couple decades has been in some sad shape, and they've been working on big breaches in the hull and some structural problems, and there was actually a danger that the Texas would actually sink in situ, right where it's at, and have to be scrapped. The hull integrity has improved with some recent repairs, and it appears that the Texas is in good enough shape that it can be towed to a dry dock in Alabama and have the hull repaired, which is great news. The state of Texas has allocated $35 million to do this, and it looks like the ship will be repaired, and it's probably going to take a couple of years, and then return to the state and displayed again, and we can enjoy it again. It's a great piece of history. This is great news. This is really great news, because it was just terrible to see the ship slowly deteriorate. I visited the ship in 2012 and really, really enjoyed it. It's an absolute historical gem, and I'm really glad that this is being preserved for future generations. It's the last of its type, and it's the last physical history that you can touch, a dreadnought battleship, which was a big deal the first half of the 20th century. That was the ship that basically fought on the seas, and more than that, they were actually they actually carried the flag and were representatives of their country. So it's the last one. Once the Texas is gone, all there's left is pictures and a few little scattered relics here and there. So this is wonderful news, and it's great to see that the Texas is going to be preserved for future generations and that we can all enjoy it. Okay, let's get into some other gun culture stuff. I enjoyed watching the series of videos on YouTube, and they're on Patreon and Full 30, I think. The Desert Brutality match that the guys at InRange TV sponsor and put on and organize every year. The two gun matches are very, very interesting. While, like any match, they don't represent or replicate reality, they are very entertaining, and they look like they actually challenge a lot of shooting skills, and there's an opportunity to use really a variety of weapons, including, you know, historical type weapons or classic type weapons, or I hate to say it, old school weapons. So this is, they're really very entertaining that way. One of the things I saw that I didn't like was in the match roundup, kind of two things. Number one, I'm not a real fan of tossing guns around, tossing them on the ground, tossing magazines on the ground. That just really reflects bad gun handling. It's really, it shows bad habits, and you don't want people to see that and kind of think it's cool and emulate it, even if it's in a joking manner. I really dislike that. And, of course, having a military background, that's an absolutely the wrong thing that you want to see. So I really think they need to, you know, stop trying to be cool and take care of the weapons like they should. It's a safety issue, and it's just an abuse issue of why would you intentionally damage something that is really done a good job for you? A rifle you just shot in a match, why would you throw it on the ground? Same thing. It's if you're in the middle of a match and you sweep a magazine out and it falls on the ground and you go on, hey, that's understood. But just tossing a magazine around willy-nilly just seems to be, it reminds me of the guys who used to slap close the cylinders on double action revolvers just because they thought it was cool and they thought it looked really good. I think that's a very, very, just kind of an unacceptable behavior. Other than that, I really enjoyed it. One of the things they did mention was the match, it has a physicality that does prevent some people from actually taking part in it. You know, I didn't see anything there that was particularly a big deal, except what they call the Carsada drill, which is taking a fairly large kettlebell, and you take that kettlebell and throw it, I think the thing was 65 pounds, and you throw it a certain distance, and then you go up to where the kettlebell landed, and that's where you shoot from, and you shoot a single shot from that position, and as far as you can throw the kettlebell until the targets are cleared. Definitely something that anyone who's had a physical injury to their back or their knees, or getting older, just something you're not going to do. And they kind of said, well, you know, this match isn't for everybody. This isn't the kind of thing to do. Well, you know, you could structure that match without some of that physicality and still have an absolutely great match. And I think if they want to see two-gun action shooting, which is really what they have there, if they want to see that expand, they kind of need to make it as inclusive as they can. Certainly something like the Carsada drill is not going to be conducive to older people or females. You know, just throwing a 65-pound kettlebell is great for young macho guys. You're in your 20s or 30s, you can do that. But when you start excluding everyone else except males in their 20s and 30s, that game will not, it just won't spread. It could wind up the same way as zoot shooting, where it's fun, it's great, but for certain reasons it just never took off. But I'd really like to see two-gun take off, because it is exciting. The kind of weapons they use are great. I think a lot of the props are very, very innovative, and I think they've done great work there. I think they just need to package it so that more people can participate. I would like to see that expanded. To me, three-gun has become too competition-focused. Too many kind of bicycle jerseys and strange shotguns, those types of things, and race guns. But this seems to be more gritty, actual kind of combat style weapons, combat style gear and equipment. And I really think that their scenarios are very, very well done. And those guys really should be commended for that. That is a stroke of genius. And they found exactly the right kind of venue to do that in. The bays they have are just long enough so you can get very challenging rifle shots, and they're short enough so that you can do a lot of pistol work. So I really think that they've stumbled onto something there. And they do the two-gun matches in Tucson, and they did the Desert Brutality somewhere north, I believe St. George, Utah, or someplace where they could find a range that would host the event. But it's absolutely outstanding. They need to do that. However, I would like to see the videos kind of cleaned up with some of the gun handling and the way they handle some of the equipment. I also kind of challenged the Finavision, which was the helmet cam. You know, once you've seen the two presenters, Carl and Ian, present their stages and go through it, I don't know that you need to see it again with helmet cams. Those really didn't interest me. I really like watching them go through it and watching the analysis, which they're very, very good at. So it's good stuff. I just think that they need to tweak it a little bit and it'll be a lot better. Last podcast talked about Zoot shooting. And look, you know, there's still some activity on the forums, and I hope that they basically have the match this year. They sometimes call it the World Championship, because there are people who actually came from overseas just to shoot in it. And as I said before, it was the most fun I ever had in a single shooting match, was at a Zoot shooting match. The only reason it's, part of the reason that it didn't catch on the way it should have, was, you know, when it was introduced, it was during the Great Recession, like 2008, 2009, and a lot of people weren't exactly into buying more guns, more equipment, more costume, if you will. A lot of people were kind of holding on to what they had, or even divesting themselves. So it just didn't light on fire the way cowboy action shooting did in the late 1980s, and kind of carry through the 90s and the 2000s. Another reason is everyone grew up with the Westerns. The gangster movies, while they were big, that demographic has kind of passed. They haven't really made a lot of great gangster movies, although I thought Public Enemies was absolutely excellent, the movie with Johnny Depp about John Dillinger, and this latest one, The Highwaymen, is excellent. And it still remains a genre that there are a lot of different movies that are out there that were never huge hits, but have become kind of cult classics. So I think there's still a chance. Really, the only way it's going to grow is if, like Wild Bunch shooting, if it can somehow get into the CAS cowboy action shooting arena and become the next iteration, the one beyond Wild Bunch shooting, then I think it'll be good to go. Right, and it wouldn't take much, because essentially you're talking shotguns, 1911s, which already exist in Wild Bunch. It would just be the addition of the Thompson and other style of carbines, and that would be really the only push past what we currently have now as the boundary, the upper boundary of Wild Bunch shooting and cowboy action shooting. So hopefully that'll kind of happen. One of the ways it can happen is kind of badger your local clubs and see if they'll let you do it. I've been kind of doing that a little bit. I'm gonna need to do it some more, but that's one way we can get this kind of rolling a little bit and have it centered not necessarily in Colorado, which was great, but also maybe have some other places around the country where we can do this kind of shooting and have these kind of matches. Okay, let's hit some Q&A, and here's one of my favorite questions that I always get. Is a single action revolver suitable for defense? And the answer is, and this comes in many questions, is it suitable for CCW? Is it suitable for home defense? Etc., etc. The people who ask this question usually know the answer. The answer is, of course it's not. And they seem to be shopping for some sort of rationale that would make the single action revolver somehow the equal of the modern combat pistols that we all see, you know, the polymer frame, high capacity, usually 9mm. Why is it not a good choice for defense? Well, if, say, some drug dealers who find your address and they mistake it for somebody who owes them money and they come busting in on you, you need a high-capacity, high-firepower weapon to fend them off. And that is not a single action. If a armed burglar breaks in and he has a high-capacity service-style pistol, and you have a six-shot single action, not only can he fire faster, but he can fire a lot more times and he can reload faster. You have six shots and then it's over. Reloading those is just too time consuming. Another form of this question is, does anyone carry a cap and ball revolver for defense? And the answer is almost the same with a couple little things. Cap and ball revolvers are fun. I shoot them. I love them. They are what a window into history they are. However, they are unsuitable for modern defense for a variety of reasons. Number one, you can leave them loaded, but black powder being essentially kind of hydroscopic will attract some moisture inside the chamber and it will pit and corrode, which is not a good thing. The next thing is percussion caps are notoriously kind of unreliable, and the system really is. The caps actually work, but if you have some clogging in the nipple that the cap is on, it may not ignite the powder charge. The cap may fall off, which would be a disaster in a self-defense situation, because now you have no way to ignite the powder charge. It's just fraught with way too many problems. There's a reason that basically cartridges really took over and put those things into history, relegated them to history, and these are all reasons why. Yes, they are fun. Yes, no one would want to be shot with one. However, keeping it for defense and thinking that it's the equal of more modern firearms is just not thinking correctly. Now, where the single action can shine is, there is another aspect of defense that really isn't addressed a lot of times, and that is, there's more than just bad people out there. Today there was a story in the news where an 11-foot alligator overnight broke into someone's home, broke through the glass at their front door, and when they wake up and go out into their kitchen for their, breakfast, there's an aggressive 11-foot alligator there. Now, in this case, they called animal control and got it out there. But what if you have a couple of toddlers? What if you have small children? You may have to kill and of course, this is kind of a gruesome thing to think about. But, if you had to kill an alligator, which has invaded your home, you need a weapon that can do that. Now, most rifles can do that. If you're an expert in alligators, you might risk it with a .22, but actually a good weapon to have would be a powerful handgun, and that can be a single action, double action, or even a powerful semi-auto. You think what cartridges would really be suitable for that, and you can really look at things, anything above a .40 caliber, probably at the low end, .40 Smith & Wesson, .38-40, its revolver counterpart, probably kind of the same thing, and then you can go up into the .44 calibers, the 10 millimeters, 10 millimeter auto would be a great cartridge to use, and that has come in revolvers too. An acquaintance of mine has a Smith & Wesson 610, which he swears by, and I think he's correct. It's a great revolver that's kind of this medium power revolver, not as much as a Magnum, but certainly more than what we're used to. A 357 Magnum would certainly be a good choice. 45 Colt, it goes on and on. I mean, there's good crap there. Now, would you want to shoot a 500 Smith & Wesson in your kitchen at an alligator? Well, probably not. But it's going to be a messy situation no matter how that goes. But there are dangerous animals out there that can come in and hurt you. And a single action, would be actually be a good choice against that. Some of the ones, they're powerful, they're accurate, and they can definitely do in some of these things. It always used to be the big fair on both internet forums and even in gun magazines was, you know, what's the best handgun for bear defense? And of course, the best handgun for bear defense is probably not having to use a handgun. You either have a pump 12 gauge with slugs or some other kind of a powerful long arm. And people would go back and forth on this, and I think even Smith & Wesson put out a short-barreled 500 Magnum for bear defense. You know, this is kind of the same thing. You want to look at it and say, you know, there are dangerous animals. Sometimes there can be dangerous livestock. You can have bulls that are dangerous. You can have other things that, you know, something you might have to put down. And if you have a handgun, that's it. I think Elmer Keith in Six Guns described having to put down some sort of a bull that I think they were trying to ride or handle in some way. And it essentially basically had him and was getting ready to stomp and gore him, and he had a handgun, a 45 Colt single action. He pulled it out and killed the thing before it killed him. I mean, this kind of thing can happen. I mean, you live out in the rural areas, it's not unheard of. And a single action is probably as adequate as anything else for that. And no handgun would be perfect in that situation. And like, as I said before, you know, the thought of shooting an alligator in your kitchen before breakfast is probably a pretty gruesome thing to do. But hey, if you got young kids and you got this thing in there, and a 10 or 11 foot alligator can kill a person easily. So, you know, you do have to think about that there are other situations besides multiple attacker home invasions, or there are other kind of home invasions that might necessitate you having a gun that can do that. The best situation, I think, is to have a variety of weapons, and if you got time to select the correct one, that's optimum. But face it, for most of us, it's going to be whatever kind of weapon that we keep for what we think is the most likely scenario of use. When I lived on a ranch, it was a lot different, and those were different times. Revolvers were the big thing, and we never would have considered a semi-automatic pistol. The main one in those days was the 1911. There really wasn't much else besides that. And we kept revolvers. And a 357 Magnum revolver was king at that particular juncture at times. So, you know, yes, they can be used. It may not always be the best choice, but it can be a good choice if you have a situation other than multiple armed attackers coming after you. Here's another question. In times of uncertain ammo supplies, what weapons would you choose to outfit yourself with? That's a very, very interesting question. Very interesting. You think in the post Sandy Hook situation where people were buying everything off the shelf, if somebody had a 32 caliber revolver and they saw 32 Smith & Wessons sitting on the shelf in any store, they bought it, whether they needed it or not. Everybody went into this hoarding mode. So therefore, you know, ammunition supplies were very, very difficult to maintain. And at the retail level, it just wasn't, you couldn't find this stuff. And it was literally, the market was swallowing it faster than they could even produce and import stuff. So those were very interesting times. If I was in times like that where I wouldn't know, you could go into a retail outlet, maybe you find stuff, maybe you don't. Maybe you find what you use, maybe you find what you don't. Here is what I found in the Sandy Hook thing. You never know exactly what you're going to find at a retail outlet when you have that kind of panic buying and hoarding. So if I were going to purchase a pistol directly for that, I think I would probably go with a Ruger convertible 357 9mm. I could use three very popular cartridges in it, depending on which one I found. I'd have another cylinder for 9mm, and then you have the regular cylinder that takes 38 or 357. That's a really good start. You could sit there and say, hey, this is the most common ammunition. I can find it, or at least I can find empties and hand load it. I can cast my own bullets, shoot it, and all three of them are pretty efficient cartridges as far as powder bullets. They shoot, you know, 125 to 158 lead bullets that you could cast yourself, and you know, you wouldn't be using a lot of lead like you would be with a 45 caliber or 44 caliber. So they're pretty economical in that way. The other way that they're very economical is they don't use a lot of powder. So if you've got a good supply of powder, good supply of primers, and lead that you can cast, you can find the empties for that. And, you know, you have a chance of running across the loaded ammunition in three calibers that you could use in one gun. Rifles are a little different. First of all, I'd stay away from anything rimfire, because you're just stuck with what you can get factory, because you can't manufacture it, you can't hand load it, you can't do anything with it, can't do anything with the empties. So you stay away from rimfire. For a rifle, you might be the same thing. Maybe a lever gun in 38-357. That would be about the most versatile you can probably do. Or you could get really high speed and go with something like a Thompson Center type rifle that you can get different barrels for, and you can have as many barrels as you want. Now, it's a single shot, but it's going to be very, very versatile. Another way to go would be some chamber adapters for different kind of rifles. 30 caliber rifles, you can shoot 32 ACP in. 45-70 rifles, you can fire 45 Colt, you know, with a chamber adapter in it, and it's usually single shots. They really don't work with repeaters like lever actions, but that would be the way I would go. You could also, if you thought that 9mm would be basically available, there's 9mm carbines. Ruger makes one, High Point makes one, and there's probably a few others out there. You could definitely go with that if you think you're going to run across factory 9mm, or if you think you can reload 9mm to the point where it'll function in those carbines. And that's not very difficult. They're blowbacks, although you can even use lead bullets in there. You might get some leading. 9mm lead bullets will lead the barrel a little bit, but you can scrub that out. So that would be where I would go with definitely with all those. That's an interesting question, and definitely one you don't really want to have to confront. Another thing is, I found that some of the, I won't say oddball calibers, I'll say more like hunting, not very well known calibers, you could still find those in Walmart and places like that during the great ammo shortage that followed Sandy Hook. Things like 270 Winchester. Not a lot of those guns around, but it's still loaded. So you can always pick up a couple of boxes of that. So you can always roll the dice and say 243 Winchester, 270 Winchester. Things like that are really kind of off everybody's radar screen, kind of the older traditional hunting cartridges. Definitely you could find some of that. What I found was hardest to find was any kind of military calibers, things like 303 British, even 45-70. All that kind of stuff vanished because there are so many surplus guns out there. So you could definitely not find a lot of that stuff, and it took a while for it to come back. And really, American manufacturers don't make a lot of that stuff anymore. If it's not Privy Partisan or PPU, as they're known now, they're really the only game in town for a lot of that. And so it's a very, very tricky question. But I would definitely go with the most versatile guns you can get, and also maybe in some guns that are in offbeat calibers where they still load it, they still carry it, but there's not a high demand for it. That's what I would use. And I think we have time for one more question, and here is a good one. Have you ever been influenced by a movie or television show to buy a certain gun? Now, when I first read that, I thought, well, the answer is obviously no. I've I enjoy seeing guns that I own on TV. I fully admit that, but I don't think one, because Charles Bronson used it or because Clint Eastwood used it, I've never gone out and bought a gun specifically for that. But then I started thinking, well, what does cause most people to buy guns? What are the commercial impressions that you get? And some of them are movies, and some of them are television shows. It's also the advertising you see in gun magazines. It's also the advertising you see on the internet. It's the YouTube videos. So what really does influence you to purchase a certain firearm? And I would have to say that I think people are influenced by visual media to purchase all kinds of things, whether they need it or not. I don't really think that there's a tremendous amount of that anymore. I mean, the two biggest examples I can think of is the Walther PPK. James Bond used it, and it became a very popular gun because, A, it's very, very attractive. The styling is excellent, and it was used in a very, very cool set of movies. You know, that whole franchise was, they still go back to the PPK every now and again, just basically because it photographs so well and they kind of pay homage to it. The other one, of course, would be Dirty Harry and his 44 Magnum, which spiked the sales of the Smith & Wesson Model 29. Obviously, a lot of people were affected by that. Other than those two, I'm not too sure that there's been a real blockbuster like that. Certainly, there have been movie-inspired guns. The Buntline Special from the movie Tombstone, that's strictly a creation of that movie, and the fact that you can still buy one from, I believe it's Cimarron Arms. Obviously, the people who see that movie are going to be influenced to buy that gun. You wouldn't go buy that gun unless you had seen the movie and wanted it. So that is a part. I think a bigger part is usually the write-ups, usually the promises of really enhanced performance, or the definitely what advantage this weapon gives you. That's usually what causes people to buy. And in some cases, it's not really the greatest. Maybe the promise of being a better marksman or better success at hunting is what influences people to do that. And especially with hunting, you can also think that, you know, the bigger kill, this is a more effective cartridge, and somehow that'll make you a better hunter. So I think all those things together, they create the advertising and help shape the demand in the gun market for these things. I would not want to be the person who needed to develop a marketing campaign. It's very, very tricky, and it would be very, very hard. And you see a lot of gun manufacturers just simply don't do that. They just put the models out there, let people do some reviews on YouTube or in the gun magazines, and go ahead and they sell from there. They don't really do a whole lot of shaping the market. But it's definitely, I think, more than individual advertising or movies, what shapes the gun market are overall trends or new trends. Things like PRS shooting, essentially unknown 15 years ago, but it kind of catches on because someone's doing it. They basically publicize it. It gets seen. It gets noticed. And all of a sudden, it becomes the very cool thing to do. The newest thing to do is the cool thing to do. High power rifle was like that for years and years, especially service rifle. Hey, it was what a kind of a macho thing to do, is go out there and shoot service rifles for scores. Well, that has kind of topped out and has stabilized. And I think fewer people are doing it because now it's this PRS. It's definitely more of a precision rifle market, and the absolutely the amount of products that support that market have exploded. And then you've also had the war on terror has brought sniping back, and you have the Chris Kyle interest. All these kind of things came together and really pushed that sport to the front. The same way that cowboy action shooting, the movies, the history, the decades of TV westerns and movies really laid the groundwork for that. And then once it started to catch on, then all of a sudden there's an explosion of products that support that market. And the tactical market has been the same way. Definitely the war on terror has influenced the interest in tactical weapons as far as AR-15s and similar types of rifles, and of course the accoutrements that go along with it, the scopes, the all of the things that make it more efficient, even improved magazines, the whole litany. There's been an explosion in that marketplace. So it's really more trends than, say, an individual movie or an individual advertising campaign that really make some of this stuff come to the forefront and become the kind of the next wave or the next generation. Plus, I think there's also an interest in being somewhat different than the previously. Nobody wants to shoot some of the guns that their fathers had. Nobody really wants to go and shoot the Remington 700 ADLs anymore. And even though they still make it, and it services the marketplace for somebody who's interested in hunting but not really that interested in rifles, wants a decent, good, solid rifle but really is not a shooting enthusiast, there's always that market. But the market where the Remington 700 factory rifle ruled the roost for hunting, that's kind of gone now, and a lot of people are into much higher end, much more specialized weapons, and that's been one of these trends. In my own case, my father's Winchester Model 88, a great gun, an interesting modern lever gun, but nobody would ever really introduce that today, and because it just wouldn't sell enough, because it wouldn't generate enough interest. I think Ruger has come out with some new, some lever guns here and there. They had a 44 Magnum lever gun, I think, and a few things, kind of a very modern type, and nobody really wanted it. They just really don't sell them, so they stay in the catalog for a few years, and then these things vanish. The only lever guns that really hang around are the ones that are, again, tied to the Old West in some way, and have that nostalgia with them. But really, the post-war kind of lever actions that came and went, nobody's really that interested in them. The Remington 700 ADL, I don't think that you could, so if you sold one of those secondhand, I don't think you'd get very much for it, unless you were selling it to somebody who's strictly going to use it as a tool. So it's the trends, the new trends, that seem to be shaping the desires and wants in the firearms market. Well, that's all we have today. Again, some people are listening to the podcast. They're absolutely following us, and go ahead, hit the follow button, and submit some questions and comments, and we'll be happy to get at them. Right now, this is Old School Guns, out.